You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Paolo Bacigalupi is the author of The Wind-Up Girl, The Water Knife, and Pump Six and other stories. He's also the author of Shipbreaker and The Drowned Cities, young adult novels. He was a finalist for the National Book Award, and he won the Hugo Nebula, Theodore Sturgeon, and John W. Campbell Awards. His new book is Nivola. Thank you for joining me, Paolo.
Thanks for having me.
This is such an amazing book, and the first way it is amazing is that you were writing a cli-fi before the phrase was a cliche, and you were really good at it. I loved all your books. This book is kind of, in many ways, the polar opposite of those books in substantially. But what made you take a turn in the direction of creating a second world fantasy?
You're right. I had spent most of my career actually writing sort of either climate fiction or environmentally focused fiction, extrapolating about the future, things like that. And there was a point where I burned out. I burned out pretty substantially, actually. And it became incredibly difficult for me to write. And what I realized was that I was sort of in this space where if your day-to-day life is full of anxieties and concerns about where is the future headed, where are we headed, what's going to happen next, and then you go into your creative life and you spend all of your time mining that, and in fact extrapolating even further and expanding on that, what it ends up doing is it creates this sort of feedback loop of anxiety, and it becomes incredibly unhealthy. And so there was a point where I really burned out and stopped writing almost entirely, and was thinking that I was probably going to just not be a writer anymore. And during that period, in kind of an attempt to kind of heal and figure out what I was doing and recenter myself, I started writing like 500 words a day of almost anything, just to touch the page, just to make something for a second, and then to walk away. Not to try to make it into a book, not to try to make it into a story, not to try to make anything per se, just to see whether or not I even liked writing anymore at all. And one of the things that I ended up playing around with was this story. And the story started with just a single line. It was, my father kept a dragon eye on his desk. And because I wasn't trying to make anything per se, that sort of felt like a doorway that I could walk through, and it opened up questions. So suddenly I'm thinking about, like, well, who is this father? Who is this man who has a dragon eye on his desk? And what does this dragon eye look like? Oh, it's going to be this fossilized thing. It's going to be sort of comet shaped. It's going to have all these trailing draconic nerves off of the back of it, ocular nerves that are, you know, sharp as daggers. And maybe it's still kind of alive. Maybe there's something inside of it. Maybe it burns with this inner fire as if it still retains life. And so, you know, there's another doorway that opens. And then there's this question about who is the child who's seeing this eye and seeing this father, and who is this boy? And each piece of that started to open up a bigger and bigger and bigger story for me. And I just kind of kept walking through doors. You know, every time there was something that intrigued me, I would tell some more of the story, and then I would walk away, and then I would come back, and I would walk away. And this went on for years. And eventually there was a point where this became the thing that I kept returning to the most of all the things that I was playing around with. And there are a variety of other stories and little bits and pieces that I created and threw away or created and set aside. But this was something that I kept coming back to. And there was a point where I had so much material that I thought, well, this is actually sort of weirdly book-like. If I sort of shave off a chunk of it and give it to my agent, what will they think? And it was utterly different than anything else I'd done before. It was, it's fantasy. It's set in this sort of Italian Renaissance-like world. It's, it's full of magic. It's full of, sort of politics and intrigue and things. It's not related to our world. It was just an entertainment for me that was a pleasure to write. And that, and so, yeah, I gave it to my agent, and I really didn't have many expectations one way or the other. I didn't really care either. I sort of was entertained enough by it that I thought, oh, if he doesn't like it or whatever, I might even make a serial out of it or self-publish it or something, just because it was fun to make. But he liked it, and then within a few weeks he'd sold it. And here we are. Suddenly I'm writing fantasy.
I really love this book. It was a pleasure to read. The prose is just wonderful. And my experience with this book was I guess odd because although I haven't made a habit of it, I watched TV with my wife and she was watching a show called Bridgerton.
Yeah, sure.
And as I read this book, I thought, well, this is kind of like the West Wing as seen through a Bridgerton filter and written by Machiavelli. And
Love that. I love that.
about the last time we talked, I had done a piece for NPR on Machiavelli's The Prince.
Okay.
I read it and I spoke with somebody who is kind of an authority on him. And his take, and my take too, having spoken with him and read the book, was that it wasn't so much advice, just really, dire advice to the most, criminally minded among us about
Right,
how to
right,
run
right.
things.
Sure.
It was more a satire of what was actually being done at the time that, broached up against the limits of what was being done, not necessarily with the eye of saying this is good, but saying this is pretty darn close to what's being done.
Yeah, Machiavelli is really interesting to me, and he was the his writings and the world that he existed in ended up being sort of inspirational, sort of launch points for me. Machiavelli, the history of the Borgias, the Medici, merchant bankers, the of course, but Leonardo da Vinci, all of these people are sort of like existing in the same period in Renaissance Italy, and there's sort of like this period of political ferment, and there's artistic ferment, and there's a sort of a sea change going on also because everybody's digging back into history and rooting around in these lost texts of the Greeks and the Romans. And one of the things that's interesting to me about Machiavelli particularly is that he's observing, all of these different sort of attempts to sort of make sense of a pretty dire political situation all up and down the Italian peninsula, and all of the different tricks and schemes that everybody's coming up with. And when you look at the prince, it's fascinating to me because, almost every time he says, something like, well, the prince has to be so ruthless that, if he runs across somebody who crosses him, he should murder them and never so that they can never come back at him again. And then he'll say, and almost the next line, he's like, of course, if you do this too many times, people will not trust you and you will be hated. And so you see this sort of, and he's doing sort of, he's sort of building this sort of a general political theory of realistic. It's real politic, and it's based on the world that's surrounding him. And I find him really, really interesting, actually. I find his whole career actually fascinating because the other part about him that delights me is that late in his career, after he'd been an ambassador, after he'd written, all these political treatises, all these kind of stuff, He also becomes a dramatist, and he writes comedies. And I love that, like, there's this whole like last period of his life where he's actually writing these very popular sort of bawdy comedies for production in various festivals in Florence and elsewhere. And yeah, anyway, so.
Nivola really, I think mines that so well. I'd like you to talk about, you said you start out writing this at 500 words a day.
Yeah.
And I thought the one of the things that was amazing to me was that as I'm reading all these like lush descriptions of life in this creation of the world, it was just so darn entertaining and beautifully written. I could not put the book down because it was just a pleasure to read. Did these words roll off the tip of your pen, or did those 500 words receive a Machiavellian treatment of their own?
There was a lot of this was pretty grew pretty organically. And it's partly because you're writing without pressure. And you're writing for this really, it's interesting. Once you become a professional writer, you're almost always aware of your story going out to an audience. You're always sort of, thinking in terms of not just what you're making, but also how it will echo out into other people's minds. And so in this particular case, because I was only working on this for my own entertainment and my own pleasure, that's actually really clarifying because it's sort of it helps you focus down onto the voice that you like and the style that's, pleasurable to you. And linguistically, I don't know, there was something very early on in the story that became where Davico, who's the young boy growing up and is also the narrator of the story, his voice was really clear to me really, really early on. And that sort of informed, every stage of the writing afterwards was, oh, how does this get written? Well, this is Davico's voice. This is how he writes. This is how he thinks. This is how he engages. And so it was, there's always a little bit of a mystery about why these words get chosen or whatever, but there was a certain amount of a sense of channeling a personality or a person. And their words and language into the story. And he has a certain way of lushly describing things, and he has a certain set of attitudes as he describes, both his physical world inside of the city of Nivola, and then also, things like the natural places like the wilds of the Roemilia outside of Nivola or whatever, when he talks about those things and all that, just comes from his voice, really. Yeah, it's a strange thing because every time you look back on a book that you've done before, you're like, how did I do that? God, I wish I knew because he seemed to do some good things there, and I wish I could just grab that and steal it again. And yeah, it's very odd, like feeling like yeah, you never can write quite as well as you wrote before, or you can never be quite as smart as you were for the last book. There's things in old books of mine that where I go back and I look at a turn of phrase or a detail, and I'm just shocked that whoever it was who wrote that, came up with those things. I'm just like, oh man, if only I could be like that person, that would be great. And that person's lost, and hopefully you're making something interesting this time.
Well, I think what you've just given is a wonderful endorsement for what I call the method acting story of writing, which
Perfect.
is,
Yeah.
because so much of it, it just feels it's like we really enjoyed Davico's presence. And one of the things I think that you do really well in this book too is to build the world visually. I mean, I could absolutely see every scene in this book, as if it were in like a super staged mini series movie. And frankly, I would be scared to see the movie, a movie made from it. It almost, although it practically makes itself, it writes itself as a mini series, just because it's so wonderfully described. It's just entertaining to be in that reading space, and
Yeah.
filling that reading space is really important. So talk about, your sense of building the world. Did you know where you were going, or were you building those scenes as you wrote them?
I knew pretty early on that I was writing inside of a world that resembled and was you know sort of inspired by Renaissance Italy. And so you have a certain sense of the physicality of the way that people are going to construct things and how what is awe-inspiring to the people and stuff like that. You know, whether it's, you know, the great dome over the Calandra, or it's the, you know, the defensive towers of the various Arcanomi, the Arcanomi or the high families or the high names in Novella. And they have all these defensive towers that are spiked around the city where they, when they have wars between the names, like everybody goes into their defensive towers and then goes and wars in the streets and then hides in the towers. And those things are sort of pulled from, I spent some time in Italy, and then I spent a bunch of time reading books and stuff like that. And so you end up with a lot of furniture that you can kind of pull in and draw in and use. So there's that. But there is, you know, I mean, there was a moment, there are things though where it's not even, I'm pulling from so many different pieces of experience and so many different details and stuff like that. So when, you know, people are bargaining over, you know, they say that they, you know, sit parlo banco, they sit across the plank from one another and they negotiate. And this is what Novellese people are famous for, is that they're negotiators and traders. You know, the dynamics of like, oh, we're going to have this, you know, sweet tea and we have bitter cheese and we have these various items. Some of this stuff is getting pulled from everything from like my wife's family in India to like, you know, she comes from a merchant caste. And so some of this is pulled from like sort of like little details from India, or this might be pulled from some small detail that I, you know, picked up somewhere back when I lived in China or something like that. And I sort of weave those things into the cultural dynamics of how the Novellese think. So they're, you know, sort of Italian adjacent, but they aren't specifically Italian. And those little details kind of add up to becoming a more whole and fleshed out world. And so, yeah, so physically, you know that there are going to be certain things. There's going to be huge cattedrali, is what they call them, cathedrals, huge cattedrali that they're going to have. And you know that there's going to be this is a republic, so you know that the Calandra is where all of the Arcanomi gather to vote on various political issues in Novella, or you're going to have these defensive towers because of this history of war between the names. So those things are kind of built in. And then you're going to have things like these giant frescoes painted on the wall in Davico's palazzo, in the palace that Davico grows up in. They have these giant frescoes painted on their walls, and these will depict, you know, the ancient gods. These will depict the history of their world. These will depict triumphs of his own family. In many cases, like if there's an image of some, you know, mythic battle or mythic other thing, maybe the gods' faces will be replaced with faces of Davico's own family within them, in this sort of very unsubtle sort of description of themselves as being powerful. And those things are, you know, sort of like being made specific to Novella and their cultural history, but they're also stolen from all sorts of details of like how the Medici decorated their palazzo and, you know, things like that. So you're kind of bouncing back and forth between creating a new world entirely, but also creating echoes from, you know, stuff you've done in research.
And the fact is very, I guess, it's all woven together really well. So all feels like it comes from one place, and that, I guess, comes from Davico. And also, you do a wonderful job with the characters and introducing a large cast of characters and giving us of hints of where things will go, but not necessarily telling us outright. And we have Davico, his father, and also his kind of a foster sister, and the relationship between him and his foster sister is just wonderfully done and tinged with just the right amount of slight distaste and heavy-duty romanticism. So talk about tackling that, because it seems like, you know, it's a fraught subject that, you know, readers, you know, might can go either way on.
Yeah, I like so Celia is this sister who's been adopted into Davico's family, and her own family was in fact sort of destroyed by Daviko's father. And then she was brought into the family as an adopted sister, maybe a hostage, hard to say. But Daviko grows up with her as his sister. And it's really fun to sort of have the interplay between Daviko, who is a, you know, the storyline overall is that Daviko is a very, very, he's a very kind, warm, open person, a very trusting person. He's a little too sincere, perhaps, for the kind of work that's ahead of him. His father is, you know, incredibly strategic and very, very thoughtful and very, very sort of manipulative. He manipulates the politics of the city through his wealth. He manipulates the politics of the people around him through various trading and promises and oaths. And in fact, manipulates the larger political landscape of the city states around them and the nation states that are kingdoms that are further away. And Daviko is expected to take the reins of power from his father. And Daviko is just a much more sweet-souled person than his father is. And so Daviko is this sort of sweetheart. And then Chilia comes on the scene, and Chilia is a wiser to the world because her family has in fact been wrecked by the politics of Nuvola and by, you know, political intrigues in Nuvola. And so Chilia is a lot wiser and a lot sharper. And she's also she's a bit of a wit as well. And so when Daviko and Chilia are together, they have this really wonderful interplay of you know, sometimes they're joking with one another, sometimes they're almost flirting with one another. Sometimes Chilia is trying to teach him something that he needs to know and understand about the world. And that relationship, I loved writing that relationship. I loved Chilia as a character and how she sort of sees the world and how clever and sharp she is.
It's a ton of fun to read, I can tell you. And, you know, it's interesting. I hadn't thought of it till just now, but in a certain sense, this book has a, you know, a heavy-duty romantic element to it, you know, a straight-up romance that, not straight up, but really well handled. And,
I like romances.
Well, you know, I have to confess, I became something of an authority in the Hallmark TV variety, I think, during the pandemic. My wife would watch them and I would
Oh, sure.
relentlessly tape them and watch them with
Yeah.
her. And so, you know, I if any AI needs tips on the on how to write Hallmark movies, I'm available, AI.
Perfect. So, but you, I
nonetheless.
didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead. You were saying though. So.
Well, you know, one thing I also really liked was the development of all the other characters. I mean,
Yeah.
the huntsman, everybody gets just the right amount of focus.
Right.
Talk about creating these characters and also involving them in this arc so that when the we see all through the entry points that everything is, you know, involved in all these politics, but when they when those fingers finally start to rise from the soil
Right,
and dig themselves out of the grave, it's
right,
thoroughly, thoroughly satisfying and
right.
entertaining. Oh my God, is you just going, all
Nice.
right.
Excellent. Yeah, I so Daviko is surrounded by people who are his advisors, who are his father's sort of henchmen or supporters and stuff. And Daviko is sort of expected to learn something from each of these advisors. And so they're, you know, so there's the, you know, sort of the head of their family guard is this guy named Agon Khan, who's very he's very noble, he's very loyal, he's very honorable, and he's an incredible warrior. And you know, so Daviko learns both sword skill from him, but also he learns to hunt from Agon Khan, and they he's sort of, you know, expected to learn sort of the manly arts, maybe you'd call that, from Agon Khan. And then, you know, there's somebody like Mario, who is the they call them numerati. He's the numerati for the bank that Davico's father runs. So all of Davico's family is part of Banca Reguli. And Banca Reguli is this huge merchant banking empire. And so Mario is the head numerati for this family. And so from Mario, Davico is learning all of the arts of, the balancing the books, of the trade language you use, the contracts that you write up, the letters that you send back and forth between your different bank branches to find out what information is going on and to learn, the subtleties of what's happening in the rest of their sort of monetary empire. And then there's the one particular character who I very much love, who's named Cazzetta. And Cazzetta is a stilettatore. He's their family dagger man, the knife man for them, and he's an assassin. And each character sort of like brings a certain, and Cazzetta is not a nice person. Cazzetta, makes sure that kills people like pretty much on command, and he's scary. They, people will, the saying is that when mothers want to frighten their children, they say like, if you don't behave, we'll send Cazzetta will come for you and take you away. And so there's this, he's almost legendarily awful. But each one of them has something to teach Davico about either the politics of their world, about the skills of his business, about what it means to be either a man or to be a bargainer or to be alert to the dangers of his political world, all those things. And Cilia is part of that as well. And so each one of them is sort of giving Davico a larger and larger sense of his own world as he's growing up. And each one of them is like, I could write epics about each one of these people. They have all their own histories. They have all their own sort of doorways into larger worlds. And so, yeah, a lot of the pleasure of writing this stuff was, every time you managed to put them together at a dinner table or whatever and have them all bounce off of each other and make comments to each other, or every time, there's some moment where, because they see the world very, very differently. And so there's always a lot of sort of excitement or frisson. Like there's there's energy between all the characters when they're together, and that's sort of a delight to write. And that was part of the whole process, was that you, oh, I got to create another character who I really enjoy. There's this character named Filippo who comes from a different bank branch, and he's incredibly bawdy and sort of inappropriate. In all cases, he's always saying the most inappropriate thing. And you're like, hey, okay, we're going to tell some more dirty goat jokes now. Filippo is famous for telling bawdy jokes about goats and priests and things like that. And so, each one of these people then populates the story, and then, they create their own ripples and stuff. It's part of the fun of the building a big world like this.
And one of the most fun things for the reader, and I imagine for you as a writer, are the pets. I mean, he has a dog named Lazy and a horse named Stut. Stub.
A pony. A pony named Stub. Yeah. So Davico, Davico is a really sensitive soul. And so the people that he gets along with best are, in fact, his hound named Lazy, who never rouses herself for anyone except for him, and his pony named Stub. And he rides Stub because he hasn't mastered sword skill well enough to have earned a real war horse. And so Agon Khan, the head of the guard, won't give him a bigger horse until he actually masters his sword skill. And Davico isn't really a killer. And so he rides this pony named Stub. And Davico's comment about this is, I like Stub. I'm happy with Stub. And that's sort of, the best window into who Davico is as well, is that the Stub and Lazy both love Davico, and he loves them in turn. And that's a very warm relationship that kind of like sort of threads through the story. And it's a gateway into something larger about Davico, which is that he's very much connected to the natural world and functions far more happily when he's outside of the city of Novala, when he's out in the wilds of the Roemilia or up in the hills, and can be out in the meadows and the amongst either the apricot trees, the grapevines, or further out into the wilds of the Roemilia where the white bark trees grow. And so that's That's part of that larger world that Dadako inhabits.
One of the joys of reading this book is your sense of neologisms. You invent a whole kind of sub-language, which generally appears in italics, from excellentissimo. Oh my God. So talk about creating these kind of words. It's lots of fun. Do you know Italian or?
I do know some Italian. And part of the reason why I started playing with language was that, so during this period of, immense burnout where I was really just not functioning extremely well, I had a good friend who's a wine importer, and so his job is to basically go out to different countries and find either wine or liquor that he wants to import to the United States. And he does a lot of work in Italy, and so he had wanted to learn Italian. He already spoke some Italian, but he had wanted to learn Italian better. And years ago, I had made a comment to him that the only way to learn a language is that you have to completely immerse. You have to be in the country. You have to speak nothing but the target language. You take your classes, but for every minute of your waking day, you'd still speak your target language. You take a language pledge, basically. And that was how I learned Chinese. When I was studying Chinese, I went to Beijing, took a language pledge, and didn't speak anything but Chinese. And what do you know? You get a lot better when you can only think or function in the target language. So anyway, there was this point where, I was completely burned out. I wasn't really doing any real work anymore. And my friend was like, "Hey, I'm thinking about actually doing that thing where we, where I go to Italy and study Italian and immerse. Do you want to come along?" And there's these moments when, like, people, if you're down in a hole and then, somebody kind of throws a rope down to you. And this was kind of one of those moments where, I had been doing some of this writing work, but I was not a functional person at this point. And here my friend sort of tosses this rope down into the hole and is like, "Hey, come with me to Italy." And all I had to do was figure out how to get a plane ticket. He had found an apartment to rent. He had found this language school that he wanted to attend. He kind of organized everything, and all I had to do was show up. And so I end up going to Italy and studying Italian intensively. In that process, then that, everything that all of the details of your life become fodder for writing and stuff. And so in that process of learning Italian, then, as I'm also fiddling around with this story that's kind of Italian based anyway, I'm starting to like play around with like, well, let's create a verb, let's create an adjective, let's, like what, and you're aware of like all the Latin cognates that are sort of echo back and forth between the different Romance languages. And you're like, oh, if you want to lean into, and I've always loved doing this with my stories, is having language kind of inform what the place is. And suddenly it's like, oh, wait, I can actually just make up my own language exactly the way I want it to be. And so, yeah, so Mario is famous for how much he likes a good wine or a good cheese, and he becomes excellentissimo when he's out of his mind, when he's really enjoying something, or when he's really obsessed with a particular food. And so that's, that becomes a word that, shows up again and again. It's like, oh, when you're out of your mind, like completely loving something, you're excellentissimo. And that, then when you're building like an entire culture, then you start finding other words that you want to use. And so one of the ones that really matters in Novella is that they're very concerned, because they're a bargaining culture, because they're a trading culture, because they're a sort of a negotiating culture, they're really obsessed with how you can read the person sitting across from you when you sit parlo banco. And that's another word that I made up. To sit across the plank from one another is to, and to speak across the plank is to negotiate. So you sit parlo banco. And then, but you, what is the other person intending, or how am I making a good deal or whatever? Well, then you're going to talk about somebody being faccio scuro, which is that their face can't be read. And this is a celebrated aspect of the Novellese. People that are like, oh yeah, he's really good at faccio scuro. So that guy, he can't be read. You can't tell what he's thinking. He's a great manipulator. Davico's father is an expert of faccio scuro. And then in contrast, there's facciocchiato, which is like you can be read easily and you're very open. People can see exactly what your intentions are. You're easily fooled. Davico is much more facciocchiato. So, the reading of the face matters. But also there's these other ideas then you start adding in. You're like, okay, well, if these Navalete people are obsessed with the face, then what do they think? Like when somebody is, when somebody has control over another person, or they've got their oath of obedience, something like that, they say that their face is marked, and so there's this idea of sfacio, to have a marked face, and so sfacio is to have a marked face as opposed to and then there's this idea of forcing sfacere, to make somebody, have a marked face or force somebody to mark their face. And typically this is the idea that somebody would get down on their knees, put their cheek against somebody's muddy boot, and they'd have a mark on their cheek. So their cheek is marked, and that means that they're owned. That they're loyal to somebody, or that they're manipulated by another person and, influenced by another person. So Davico talks a lot about how his father holds the oaths of many people, but he's too sort of civilized to force facere, to force the person to get down and mark their face. And yet he does actually own them and control them and manipulate them. And then, beyond that, then the way that the Navalese people, there's another word that they have called sfacito or sfacita, which is somebody who's had a marked face, and it's specifically somebody who's a slave. And so the Navalese people will mark the cheeks, and they'll actually brand both cheeks of a person who's been enslaved, and that person is called sfacito or sfacita if it's a female. And like all of these things, then are you're building this larger and larger and larger world. And it's the same thing with Stiletto Tore. It's like, oh, how do you, this is a world that's full of assassins, and they have their own name for them. They're Stiletto Tores, the people who wield stilettos, the people who, stab each other with daggers and knives. It's just like you just keep going with this. And like, this is just like I think all of these words are probably introduced probably in the first, like, probably the first chapter, and then there's more. And I just got to keep making up words and making up stories and making up ideas and creating language for it.
It's really fun. And one of the things that's interesting in this book, as immersive as it is of, the world you create, it's also incredibly echoing of our world. And this, the idea, the visions of politics that you mine out of this are, not. They're specific both to the world you create, but they're also, I mean, they're very universal. And I'll read a brief passage here. The difference between republic and monarchy, Cassetta said as we rode between tightly packed red brick buildings and the smoke and the heat were dizzying. No politic avoids self-interest. If the Arcanomian rule, they rule for themselves. It's why we limit the number of nobili anciens who sit in the calendra and balance guilds and vizionome against them. With all interests represented, politics becomes a fairer sport, if only because everyone is equally corrupt.
Right. No, the idea that, yeah, if it's and yeah, that's the idea that, if you have a group of people who are incredibly wealthy, like the noble nobili anciens, they're going to, and they control politics, they're going to manipulate politics for their own benefits. And of course we see this, it's like it's the idea of regulatory capture when we have people who can pay lobbyists in Congress or whatever. That's, it's a universal phenomenon. And so the idea, though, that if you have a republic, or if you have more people interested, then you have at least fairly or equally competing interests trying to get theirs. And so that means, in Davico's world, it means that the Via Nome also have a voice. The people of the street also have a voice, along with the Arcanomi, the people who are the nobles, essentially, of the city. And that creates a more balanced, not a fair, not a kind, not a decent politics, but a more balanced warring of interests within politics. And yeah, no, those ideas. And that's, that's the stuff where you're taking stuff from Machiavelli, where he's thinking about, what are the dynamics of different kinds of organization of politics, and what happens when you organize in different ways. Yeah, anyway, no, I'm fascinated by all that stuff, and it's all universal stuff. Of course, it echoes into our present. You know, we're always the same. We always have the same dynamics where people are self-interested and they will pull all the levers that they can to benefit themselves. You know, that's just human nature. And so when you build government or you build politics, you have to sort of build it specifically understanding that, and all of your checks and balances need to be focused more on the idea, not that everybody's good, but that you can balance all those self-interests out in some way that creates a more equitable outcome.
You use the word balance, and I was just thinking that the way you plot this, it's almost like a game of Jenga, where you have all these blocks, and we see things slowly building up, but we're seeing them from DiVincenzo's point of view, and he is, somewhat naive, and a sweet kind of sweetheart. So when somebody pulls out the blocks, and this happens partway through the book, I don't want to say what. Exactly what happens, but it is so rewarding in the plot to see, that his whole vision of things come tumbling down and
Right. Yeah. I think all my books sort of have this interest in this idea that like you can't actually see all the moving parts of your world, and that there are surprises out there that you think you understand your world, you think you understand all the dynamics inside of it, and then, oh wait, there's something we missed. And it actually matters. The thing that you missed, you know, it's that it's that problem of like you can become expert in a realm, but just because you're expert in one realm, it doesn't mean that you know all. And so in Davigo's world, you know, everything is centered around this idea of manipulating politics, of controlling the power that's inside of the city, that's controlling the and manipulating the politics of the surrounding city states and kingdoms. And Davico's father is very good at this, but that doesn't mean that there aren't other people plotting and that there aren't other people who are good at this as well. And those surprises, you know, can come unexpectedly and with a great deal of impact.
I'm looking at where you're sitting. Is that a map of China or is that a map of Nuvola behind you?
Oh no, this is a Japanese screen actually. Yeah, it's an old it's a decorative screen from about the oh, I guess it must be about the 1800s. And I inherited it from my grandmother actually. But yeah, no, this is part of like I've got, you know, my wife, you know, she's Indian. My grandparents, my great grandparents actually were really interested in Asian art, and so we end up with, you know, a lot of that kind of art around the house and stuff like that. It's you know, it's beautiful. So
Do you have a map of Nivola somewhere?
I do. Yeah, as I was writing the story, I actually created a full map of Nivola. It's sort of a it's similar to, you know, the world of the Mediterranean or something like that. You know, instead of the Mediterranean, it's the, you know, the Cerulean Sea or the Cerulean Ocean. La Cerulea is the major ocean that's right beside them. And they live on the Cerulean Peninsula, Peninsula Ceruleana, and that's they affectionately also call it the hook because it's got all these like sort of hooky pieces that kind of come off it in a couple of different barbs that sort of fall, you know, sort of scoop off of the peninsula. And then to the north, there's the great mountain range called the Cielo Frigo, which is this absolutely icy high mountain range. And beyond that would be Wüstholz, which is, you know, sort of similar to a Germany perhaps. And then off to the west of them and north and west of them is Charroux, which is the, you know, sort of a similar place to France perhaps. So you know, you're building that kind of thing, and then there's the Kur Empire off far to the east. There's the land of Shim, which is very far away and where silk comes from. There's Kus in the south, which is sort of legendary for its warriors and their standoffishness towards anybody who tries to land on their shores. You know, and yeah, so you just build out this whole world. And yeah, so I created a map and stuff, and I think maybe you have the ARC, but there is a map actually printed now in the final book. And it's lovely. The artist who did it did a really great job of sort of giving it a sort of a Renaissance design style. And you know, it's fun to see those things kind of come into, I don't know, come into some reality. They live inside your head and then they become, you know, real. It's pretty cool.
You know, there are a couple of breaks in the book where you tell like folk tales kind of from the religious and religious like little parables. Talk about creating the religion and, you know, using that as the foundation, you know, part of your characters, characterizations, but also using it as a part of the plot or like little mirrors that will reflect parts of the plot.
So like so you know, so this is this thing is I'm playing around with this world. I'm building it, I keep building it. I'm writing 500 words a day, sometimes 1,000 words a day, whatever. I just add stuff and I keep playing around, and anytime there's something interesting, I go and pursue it. So there's some moment where you're starting to think, well, what's this, what's their religion like? And you're like, oh, I like kind of like having a pantheon of gods. And so you start creating your pantheon of gods, and you're like, okay, so there's a ruler of the sky and there's a ruler of the deeps, of the sea, and you know, there's Cerulea, their daughter, who's the ocean, you know, and then you're like, oh, and then there's Amo, who he's of the light, the sun, and then there's Scuro of the unseen realms, the darkness, the underworld, you know, there's Caliba, who's a trickster, there's Argo, who forged the world, and there's one other god named Virga, and she's the one who wove the world. She took all of life and she wove it all together. And so, you know, as I'm making up these stories about these different gods and stuff, I'm also starting to build like these world myth creations and these, and then as an offshoot of that, I end up building like also philosophies and philosophers. And so Virga, who wove the world, and so she creates the weave, and she's, you know, think of this as this very rich tapestry of all the birds, all the animals, all the trees, all the people. Everything is woven into the weave, and this is the first tapestry of life that's created, right? And but it's said that, according to the philosopher Sopros, as everyone knows, right? You know, because I'm creating this thing, it's like, oh yeah, Sopros, of course, yeah. So Sopros has this philosophy, and he says, so Virga wove the world, and there was one problem with it. There was one flaw in the weave, and that was man. That was human beings, and man fought against the weave. He didn't like being tied into the weave, and so he fought and fought and fought, and he fell out of the weave, and he landed down on the dirt, and he's this sort of sad, lonely creature that's fallen out of the weave, fallen out of all of nature, and he's sitting there crying in the dirt, and Virga takes pity on him, and so she has another of the gods, and if I'm remembering this right, it's Scuro. Scuro gives him language and sort of sends him off. You know, he can talk to one, he can talk to other human beings. Like that's what he gets. Like he's no longer part of the weave, but he can talk. He gives him language and he sends him off. And human beings and nature are forever after sort of separated from one another. And so you have this idea of the weave, and that's what Sopros calls Firmos, which is the stable world, the big natural world all around. And then there's this other part, which is what human beings created after they kind of stumbled away from the weave, and that's called Cambios, change. And that's the world of change. That's the world of human activity. And Cambios is where you have castles and you have swords being forged and you have, you know, wagons and wagon wheels and axles, and also you have things like banking, merchant banking, things like that. That's part of Cambios. The world of man, the cities, all that, that's Cambios. Firmos is the wilds and nature. And so those, you're building out that idea both of a philosophy of how people exist in relation to nature, but you're also building like this mythology as well. And then on top of that, there's this quality in Davico, which, you know, he gets along with his hound and he gets along with his horse very well. And it turns out when he's out in Firmos, when he's out in the natural world, that's when he's most at home. That's when he's most at ease. That's when he's most comfortable. And so there are a number of scenes of him either foraging in the forest with there's a physician named Delacavallo who takes him out and they forage for everything from mushrooms to various herbs, for healing plants, things like that. And that's where Davico feels most at home and most at ease and happiest. And this relates also then to the dragon eye that sits on his father's desk, because the dragon is without question part of Firmos as well. The dragon eye is part of the weave, and the soul of the dragon that's trapped within it is part of the weave, and it's a very, very powerful force. And so, yeah, like you just, but you know, like I ended up building this world, and then all these philosophies, and then all of these gods, and you know, it just kind of keeps going and going and going. So.
It seems like you had fun doing it, and as readers, we just have a blast reading through it. Now, the cover of the book shows a dragon's eye.
Yeah.
On the first page, Davigo finds it and becomes, enchanted by it. And for the rest of the book, I kind of give us a micro dose of that kind of elements of the fantastic. I mean, they're
Yeah.
there. There are fata in the forest, which are maybe undead, the
Like,
undead
think of them as
life.
like fairies or maybe as nymphs or dryads or something. That's kind of what fata are. Yeah. The fata, like they come out of the woods, they come in the water, they So that's what the fata are. Yeah. Go ahead,
You
sorry.
give us kind of this microdose of the fantastic.
Yeah.
One of the things about this book that I think is fair enough to say is you will be writing more.
Yeah.
The first question I have is, the economics of that. Have you already written it? Is the sequel dependent on the sales of the
No,
first?
this is a multi-book deal. Knopf is already committed. They're waiting for me to finish the next volume. I'm about halfway done with it right now. I know the structure of the story. I'm sort of down in the weeds right now. I was hoping to actually have everything done and locked in before book tour started. But that's it just there's too many things happening already as we gear up for tour and everything. So it's going to take a little longer for me to finish it. But no, the next book is contracted and on the way, and yeah, it's in process. So
I'd like you to talk about, using the elements of the fantastic in a story that where the weave of the norm of the elements of this world is just so imaginative and well done and exciting to read. Talk about, weaving those, the weird in.
yeah, I like having the fantastic elements. I wanted this to be a pretty grounded world, though. And I wanted magic to exist in this world as something that's pretty profoundly numinous. It's not something you can categorize exactly. It's not something that you can say, oh, here are the exact rules of magic. But I wanted this sense that there is some sort of numinous kind of powerful forces outside of the realm of the human, also in play. And that's partly, embedded into the mythology. That's partly embedded in the idea of the dragon's eye. When something magical happens, you want it to feel profoundly magical. You want it to be sort of shocking and also feel entirely natural based on what you understand of the world. And that's I mean, right from the very beginning when I was working on it, I knew that there was going to be a layer of magic in it. I didn't want to have like wizards casting spells, that kind of thing. Which frankly I also enjoy, but not for this book. And it was just I don't know. It's hard to say. Like it's just I wanted it to be present and I want it to be meaningful, and I also wanted it to not dominate the overall dynamics of the way that people move through the world. I wanted it to be a mysterious thing, a mysterious force.
We will look forward to exploring your mystery further when we read Novoa and its forthcoming sequel. I've been speaking with Paolo Bacigalupi. I've been speaking with Paolo Bacigalupi about his new book, Novoa. Thank you for joining me, Paolo.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.